Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today's programme is jam-packed, full of art. We'll be starting at the week's biggest art opening, Basquiat. Boom for Real is 21 years since the last major show of work by the American artist in London. Has the Barbican done it justice in their new exhibition? Joining me in the studio to discuss will be Ossian Ward, head of content at the Listen Gallery, and Jane Morris, art critic and editor-at-large of the art newspaper. We'll also get some alternative art picks of the week from our experts, head to a cosmic commemoration of the Cassini space probe, find out how you put an art exhibition on the silver screen, and if all that gallery talk has you scratching your heads, then we'll have some musical relief at the end with this week's global countdown. So stay tuned. Jane and Ossian, welcome to the show. Very good to have you both with us. Let's kick things off with one of the greatest art events in London this year, Basquiat Boom for Real show at the Barbican, which opened just this week. Before we discuss it, let's maybe provide a little context for listeners who may, Jane, not be completely au fait with Basquiat. Why is he so important? Maybe just what would be your pithy one-liner in answer to that?
I think probably he encapsulates the kind of late 70s, early 80s in New York, that kind of fusion of art, graffiti, hip-hop, celebrity, and some quite serious intent in one artist.
Correct.
Well, there you go. I asked for pithy, and I served it right up. Ossian, let's talk a bit about the exhibition and its execution, because I guess, to pick up on those themes that Jay mentioned there, that's kind of what I was expecting, and indeed, there's lots there. Did you find it's a well-executed display? Were there any holes or any things that left you pondering?
I don't know. I think it shows his range, which is one thing, because, you know, you're going to go in there looking for kind of classic Basquiat. Maybe there are not enough big paintings, but we can talk about his market later. It would be difficult to put on a show of his big paintings because they're now here, there and everywhere and very highly prized. But this was more about the drawing, the music, the performance, the early days. I mean, you know, it's difficult to recreate his graffiti, so the graffiti section of it are just snaps of his tag, Samo or Samo. That's okay, but I like the fact that it's low on gimmicks, because you could think, Basquiat, let's put in some turntables and some kids break dancing, and, you know, they could have gone really wrong. And I think they've treated him with reverence, and that's the way to go, not to kind of play up to the hype.
And Jane, what about the origin story? Because I guess if I was disappointed by anything, it was only a little bit this idea that he just seemed to be, if not a finished article, someone who arrived on that scene that you described at, what, sort of 18, 19, prodigiously gifted. And I still wasn't quite sure, after strolling through, and it is an amazing array of work on display, quite how he arrived there. I mean, I guess the origin story is short because he was so young and so precocious, but I don't know, did you feel a better understanding of the man after going through the exhibition?
Now, that's a tricky one, actually, because I know a bit about his starting. I was saying to Ossian that I actually saw the 1992 Whitney show of his. There haven't actually been very many big shows of his work. This is much, much, much bigger than the Serpentine show of whatever it was 20 years ago. 97, was it?
96, yeah.
And the last really, really big show that I saw was, in fact, the one at the Whitney in 1992, which was 4 years after he died, famously, infamously, of a heroin overdose. So, yeah, I mean, in fairness, I haven't read every label in the show, so maybe it is all there. Did you see much about the origin? I do know the story, but it's whether in the show.
I mean, no, it's not all there, because, I mean, I like the graffiti era and the tagging era and the way he kind of sort of jostled between the street and then suddenly the gallery. And then there's the moment where he approaches Warhol through a restaurant window and tries to sell him a postcard. You know, there are these moments you get from the show, but you're right that it's not overly biographical. And is that, I think that's good for the work. I do. I don't think it, you know, I think, again, they could have gone, you know, more down the kind of Kurt Cobain, you know, young man died in his prime sort of stuff. And just let the work speak for itself. So his story is so interesting, you have to pick at it. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe they don't tackle that head on enough. You know, there are issues about the way he was co-opted, about the way graffiti was co-opted, taken off the streets and put onto walls. You know, there's this famous show at PS1 called New Wave, and you look at the pictures of it, and actually they've done a beautiful installation of some of his paintings from that show, which were kind of hung in different ways. And you look at the other work there, and you're like, wow, that was a mess. You know, it didn't really make much sense. And we still have that problem of kind of, what do you do with street art? How do you contain it within a gallery? And those things aren't picked up on. So there are gaps. There's going to be gaps.
Yeah, although I think the interesting thing is, because weirdly, I know that he was known for this tagging and this same, you know, which is, I think, his same old bullshit or whatever it stands for. I don't think he was really a graffiti artist ever. I mean, yes, he did go around tagging. He actually comes from quite a middle class family. I mean, we haven't actually mentioned he's black. He's from a black middle class family in Brooklyn. He went to very good schools. He was an educated guy. And there's this quite interesting story, which I don't actually think is in the show, but he meets Fab Five Freddy at a party in 79. There is something in the show on that. But the interesting thing is that the rap artist later said that the thing they talked about was art, and they talked about who were their favourite artists. And they both agreed on Warhol, and Basquiat said Jasper Johns, and Fab Five Freddy says Rauschenberg. And this is how their friendship starts. It starts in a conversation about art. And I believe he was a junior member of MoMA. So, you know, he was very knowing in what he was doing. And in fact, some of the suspicions about him, I would say, has often been around the fact that he was creating an image very young, wasn't he? I mean, this, him as a graffiti artist was part of the mythology around himself that he made early on.
But wasn't he always fairly transparent about that? You know, his interest with Warhol's sharedness and notions of celebrity and this kind of thing. It was always fairly frank. And even in his tagging, a lot of the phrases he would use were very knowing. They were sort of a bit critical and self-referential. They were about the art movement and this sort of thing. But he was always transparent about that value system, no?
Yeah, and I think you're right to say that he was a little bit apart from the kind of almost those two scenes clashing, the kind of New York punk disco Studio 54 and then the Fab Five Freddy Bronx Queens hip hop. You know, he wasn't really in that scene. You know, that was part of this kind of mythology. Keith Haring was his favourite artist, but then this show is very keen to point out that he had books about Leonardo, and he was, you know, there's a great painting with a lot of references to Leonardo and one about Titian. You know, he was educated, and, you know, it wasn't the guy from the streets. That's the myth. But then the idea that he was sort of co-opted, again, I use that word, into the art world is also slightly problematic, because I don't think he fully understood what was going on. And obviously he didn't, because he ended up the way he ended up, you know, and maybe he wasn't sort of that. I have some issues with all of that. But yeah, I think in that time in New York, they had everything, high, low, rich, poor, you know, it was all a melting pot, you know, all the usual cliches. But that was kind of what was going on. You do get that from the show. There's some nice moments with some sort of photography from that era. So
let's unpack the melting pot a little further. We headed down to the media preview earlier this week and caught up with the assistant curator, Lottie Johnson.
Get funky in the place. I think I didn't really realise how much of a polymath he was and how he worked in so many different mediums. So he started off spray painting these incredibly poetic graffiti statements on the streets of New York. And then he also kind of worked as a performer, and he DJed in the Mud Club and Area and these other downtown clubs. He also produced a record called Beat Bop, which was published in 1983 and is now this kind of holy grail reference point for lots of hip-hop musicians today. As well as being obviously this incredibly prolific painter, and he made sculptures and objects. So I think before I started working on this show, I hadn't quite appreciated how far-reaching his practice was and how interdisciplinary he was as an artist. No sense trying to help, it's really no use. Think the world's messing up, let me tell you that you are rocks trying to pop. I mean, the focus of the exhibition is really this encyclopedic range of his source material. As you said, he was influenced by so many different mediums and energies and artistic practices. You know, when he worked in his studio, he often had bebop jazz playing on the record player. He had the television on, playing cartoons. He had books open on African history, on symbols, on his art historical heroes. He was constantly working, kind of pulling from all of these amazing different source materials and references, and these feed directly into his work. So he was kind of sampling and copy and pasting these reference points and kind of subsuming them, absorbing them into his work. And so the exhibition really celebrates that, the kind of diversity of his reference points. And I think that feels like a very proto-contemporary way of working. I mean, now we work from, we have this amazing access to so much information and we pull from so many different sources. And Basquiat was kind of doing that before the internet. So he feels incredibly prescient, and it feels like an urgent exhibition to do because people haven't had access to his work, because there's a whole young generation of people in London who haven't been able to see his works in the flesh. So it's a wonderful moment to be able to share that with people. It's been a really fascinating process. I mean, I think we've worked very hard to pull together a selection of works that really express the energy and diversity of Basquiat's practice, but also situate him in the downtown scene in New York. That was really important to us, to kind of chart this trajectory early on in his career, the people that he was hanging out with, this community of kind of artists, friends, collaborators in the downtown scene, Keith Haring, Andy Warhol, Ramel Z, Toxic, this incredible range of influences and kind of reciprocal influences from other artists. A lot of Basquiat's work directly addresses his own contemporary politics, especially racial politics, and a lot of the works in the show have this incredible kind of layered history. He was a searing critic of racial prejudice in society, and I think that feels incredibly resonant today. I mean, for example, one painting, Hollywood Africans, charts his road trip in 1982 to 3 on the west coast of California with Toxic and Ramel Z, two kind of artist musician friends, and they mockingly referred to themselves as the Hollywood Africans purely because there were no Hollywood Africans. They couldn't see any black representation in the Hollywood industry. So it's this really biting critique of the entertainment industry and the lack of black representation at that time. But it's also this celebration of these three artists kind of feeding off each other's energy on this road trip on the West Coast. And it has this incredibly kind of vibrant yellow swathes of paint that kind of sing out of the canvas. So a work like that, I think, is just an example of how nuanced Basquiat's understanding of contemporary politics was. And that does feel very resonant in today's society. I like a rodeo, big duck.
I like a DD, hopping with the BB, king of the mic. I like a... Lottie Johnson there, assistant curator of the Basquiat exhibition at the Barbican. Ossian, there is a lot to take in. We talked about it already. It's quite frenetic. There's so much detail, as Lottie was describing it, this mix of influences. And she also talked about the fact that many people, certainly in this country, haven't had the chance to see the work. And I think I'm right in saying there's none of his works are held in public exhibitions, I think. Now, that's maybe understandable as there's less of it and it's become hugely prized, you know, $110 million last year. That's a shame. Is that an avoidable occurrence when you get that sort of absence?
Yeah, and when you have a career, he would have been, you know, in his mid-50s now. His career was very short, so, yeah, he was prolific, but that work has become an art world darling. And I wouldn't say that was necessarily just as a result of his fame. There's also been this kind of market for his work that's followed a Warhol-style market. I mean, Jane will know better than I do who these characters are that have, you know, supported his market and made the work expensive. But, you know, he also has, and that's a shame because that means that it's controlled, let's say, by a few number of people because the estate is not large and the works are dispersed. So it's controlled. You can't get access to it. It's not freely available. So, yeah, we haven't had that much of it in London, but it's in the general consciousness. It's a young person's show. Young people will love to go and see this. It's already booked up for the next couple of weeks. I think the idea that people like Jay-Z and, you know, other rappers will talk about Basquiat as being kind of hero of the art world that didn't exist in a black Afro-American way at all until recently, you know, is also indicative of the fact that a new generation will discover him. And that's why this is really great, this show. And I think it's a shame you can't borrow bigger paintings or, you know, have the full range of his work because, it, you know, it's just hard to come by.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this issue with Basquiat and the market is, it was even an issue at the time. One of the reasons museums, and it's not just museums here, it's museums in America too, didn't collect his work was because he became expensive very quickly. Mm. Now, weirdly, that one that just sold for $110 million, which I think was at Sotheby's in May, actually sold first time, I think, in 1984 for $19,000 or $20,000, which now doesn't sound very much. But it was a lot of money for an artist who was 23 or 24 then. And many people, many museums, didn't feel that they wanted to take a punt on such a, by those standards, expensive, because we are now so far away from the kind of prices that people used to think were expensive in the 90s. Museums used to wait a good 10 years, didn't they, Ossian?
Yeah.
A good 10 years before they bought anybody, and normally that would have been fine. He became expensive very quickly. He was promoted heavily by Bruno Bischofberger, and Ernst Beiler, I think, bought a lot of his work. And his work very quickly went into private hands, where it has stayed, except being resold, as you've said, through a fairly tight network of people who are, you know, paying increasingly large prices.
It's when you wish you were there, when he was selling those postcards for a dollar a go with his pals.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's funny that there's this kind of Banksy version. He's done a couple of pieces nearby, unofficial or official collaboration, who cares? I mean, Banksy obviously...
There was someone in a high-vis Barbican jacket standing by. It looked pretty official to me.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yeah, I guess that's because they're now thinking they should preserve it. But, you know, obviously, he needs to pay reverence. He owes a lot to Basquiat's reputation. But the idea that he was that kind of a figure, you know, and I think that's reflected in the way that people look at him now.
Just very briefly, Jane, before we move on, in terms of legacy, there's a, in the little programme notes, there's a Glenn O'Brien quote, and this is a verbatim quote: bebop, cubist, pop art, cartoon, gospel, synthesis. Is that the legacy of Basquiat, or can you do better?
I certainly can't top the late Glenn O'Brien, a great writer who was part of the scene. I think he was a great appropriator, and I think, as you say, a lot of young people will really enjoy it. Quite a lot of us older people enjoyed it too.
Indeed. Basquiat Boom for Real is on at the Barbican until the 28th of January. And if that show is all booked up this weekend, which, as Austin suggested, I think it is, there's plenty more to see in London this week. Down in South London, we have a show called Natural Selection by father and son duo Peter and Andy Holden. Austin, tell us a bit more about these two.
Yeah, this is a switch from Basquiat. So basically, Andy Holden is an interesting young British artist, but his dad, for many years, was a leading figure in the RSPB. He was a avid bird watcher. He even had his own TV show, you know, kind of David Attenborough style, peering into nests and like the original kind of spring watch. And so what you get is father and son on screens chatting about birds and bird watching. And so stay with me here. But it's really interesting because of the way they do it. You know, they're obviously passionate. Andy, younger, admits that he wasn't quite sure about it for this 40 years of dad banging on about it. But now it's become part of his work. So as a contemporary artist, he's made films about it. He's started to collect his own nests, and he's made these two beautiful films, which are about, essentially, it's like watching a natural history programme. You know, it tell you about the kind of nests that birds make, and then they show you some that they've collected. I mean, it's a bit of a shame because you want to see more of these objects. And so in the film, you get to see these amazing African nests that are, you know, like huge tubes where snakes can't get into them, or tiny little gossamer thin things created by birds or stitched together with bits of twine. It's quite incredible what you learn and what my kids learn. They were like, wow, you know. And in the centre, there is a giant, I think it's a bowerbird nest, which is like this kind of quite amazing geometrical shape of twigs, kind of in a almost like a throne or something in the middle of the room. So they made a giant version, but in the film you see them handling all these other ones. I think they're at the Bristol Museum, and you kind of want more, so you want to see more nests. And then downstairs is interesting because there's this whole thing about egg collecting and egg poaching and egg stealing. So there's a whole array, 7,000 eggs in a room downstairs in this old library, which kind of allude to the fact that there is another life to these things, that they're kind of, you know, there's an illicit side to bird watching or twitching.
Yeah, twitches. But there's also, is there something about, there's nests and eggs and there's animal homes, and this is a father and son project. Is it also about paternalism in some way, or the father-son dynamic? Is that something that comes through? And it's interesting, am I right in saying the museum itself was founded by a father and son team? A perhaps accident of history? I don't know.
Yeah.
Or is that deliberate? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I think in true Art Angel style, you get the atmospherics of, you know, a sort of building used. In this case, it's a library on the Walworth Road, you know, a kind of unassuming kind of place. But you go down into the basement and there are all these kind of racks of storage rooms and vaults that used to be there. So you get, there is an atmospheric element to the installation. But yeah, ultimately what you get is a kind of an intimate and tender portrait of this dad and his son, you know, going around collecting nests and being into the same thing. You know, there's something kind of nice about that. But I think what's interesting is the dad is the enthusiast, and then the son sort of extrapolates and makes it a little bit more theoretical. So when he will start talking about what the birds do or their nature, he will start talking about them creating objects. Like these, what he found was these nests are actually like art objects. Like why do we not look at them as something created? And indeed, they influenced the earliest weaving or techniques or whatever, you know, that he really kind of is seeing more in there rather than just habit and behaviour, you know, natural life. He's looking at these as kind of like mystical objects, and that's kind of interesting. And then you get, you know, he's talking bird downstairs, so you get the little crow going, wow, wow, but it's actually him voicing it over. So you get, you know, it does become art at some point. And the and these beautiful eggs that I mentioned, they're not the real things because they found all of these eggs in this one guy's house. And there's an interview with this guy who... he's not actually that sorry about this whole episode. He's just said he loved it. He loved finding these things. This was his life's passion. So there's this other weird, sinister side. And actually, Andy, the artist, has remade all of these eggs in porcelain, and they're very beautiful.
Well, I was going to ask, Jen, we often talk about, you know, what is art? And these sound from Ossian's descriptions as if they are beautiful art objects, and yet they're fashioned by birds who presumably don't have a sense of any sort of aesthetic. They're just functionality. It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. It sounds great, actually. So is the building a kind of sort of atmospheric building, or is it just something sort of, is it some fantastic Victorian building, or is it just a kind of plain place but it's good inside?
Yeah, I mean, it's not got the real atmospherics of some of the great Archangel works. It's an old library, but that fits with this kind of pseudo academic, you know, like they're both wearing the kind of like bad tweed and tie. You know, it does feel like you're in an educational situation. You're reading a kind of bird watching book, and my kids' eyes are rolling backwards, and then suddenly they're like, oh, wow, I had no idea, you know, that bird did this, or, you know, lived for this long, or, you know, so they've put it there for a reason, and they're very upfront about this being in that register, you know, the kind of Attenborough tones and hushed tones of twitching. It gets a bit more sinister downstairs. So.
Good. And on a point of information, is there such a thing as bad tweed, Ossian? I don't know. Controversial.
Bad tweed.
Maybe it's all good tweed. Natural Selection has been put on by Archangel. It's on at the former Newington Library in South London until the 5th of November. Finally, let's head to the Royal Academy for a show called Jasper John's Something Resembling Truth. Here we have another retrospective of an American artist who hasn't had a major show in London for a long time, 40 years, I think, in fact. Jane, we mentioned Mr. John's earlier. Why now? And is the time, maybe the time is always right?
Well, I mean, I asked this because we've had a lot of this. We had a big abstract expressionism show at the Royal Academy, and then there was a big Rauschenberg show at the Tate. And I was thinking about this when I was going around Venice and Documenta, where there was barely an American painter, male American painter. I think Stanley Whitney, who I think is
one of ours,
Listen
Gallery, yeah,
was one of the very, very rare exceptions included in Documenta. And in London, we seem to be having a massive rash of shows of American, great American artists from the past sort of 50 years. And funnily enough, if Basquiat wasn't on at the Barbican, I guess that this probably would have been the show that everyone would have been saying was the must-see of the freeze period. So it's a very, very large show. It's 150 paintings. And according to the curator, Edith Devaney, it was because she was working on the Abstract Expressionism show that she realised that John's was still working. Now, I don't know if you all knew that he's still working, because he's a great age now. I mean, he was born in 1930, so he's in his late 80s now. Apparently he still paints every day. And she saw a show of his at Matthew Marks and realised that he was still working. And she got to meet him, and he's famously reclusive. I mean, and I'm sure he's perfectly easy to get on with at a sort of personal level, but he doesn't tend to like interviews and journalists and galleries and all the hoo-ha of the art world. And it sounds like they struck up a friendship, and she persuaded him that it'd be a good time to do a show. And I guess he's probably thinking about legacy. The RA is the one that got the show.
Ossian, Jasper John said about art, I don't think it matters what it evokes, as long as it keeps your eyes and minds busy. And I wonder whether you would do you agree with that sentiment broadly?
Yeah, I mean, keep all parts of your body busy. It depends how cold or miserable you are at the time. I think that his trajectory is interesting, from being not one of the abstract expressionists, not one of the leading lights, you know, being in the background, being a mixture of pop and ab X, and then kind of really outlasting everyone, you know, who's left alive from his generation now. I guess it's really him, you know. So
yeah, it is him.
It's interesting. I look forward to seeing that. What are the new works like, though? That's always the kind of, yeah, you know,
there's been an issue with some of the critical reception, is that fair to say, of the, well, I guess, what, into his kind of sixth active decade, maybe not received, as perhaps one might expect of someone in there.
I can't say honestly that the last room is not, in my opinion, the strongest room in the exhibition. Having said that, there's quite a few of those, I think they call them, do you pronounce it catenary? I've never known how to say that word. It's like a loop. It's like the suspension bridge loop, where a loop hangs off some kind of grid or, you know, squared off poles. He's made a lot of works that they look a bit like blackboards. They're grey or similar colours, and they have these sort of string loops. And those looked very nice, actually. But as I say, no, the last room wasn't my favourite, just like I didn't love the work that Twombly made at the very, very end. Funny enough, I loved the work that Twombly made in his 70s. But, you know, I mean, there was a period where people didn't like late Picasso, and now it's all being,
or de Kooning, yeah.
It's all being massively reevaluated. So who knows how those last works will be seen in, you know, 20, 30, 40 years' time. What Austin said was interesting. I mean, I think he's become a big deal, partly... Not, I don't think it's just because he's the sort of last survivor now, because I was sitting there and I was thinking, yeah, you're right. Twombly's dead now. Rauschenberg's obviously dead. Ellsworth Kelly, you know. Mm. So I can't think of anyone. Somebody, when we finish this programme, will send a text in saying, how dare you forget, you know, insert famous name. But I think it's also because he's a lot more conceptual than the Abex group. I mean, a lot of this work is about... I could feel myself reaching for my semiotics, you know, textbook, because a lot of this stuff is about signs and signifiers and words and language. And, you know, if you take a word like the or no or liar and just put it on a work by itself, what does that do to that word? You know, if you write the word red and paint it in blue, or, you know, the other way around, what does that do to our perception? So he's a lot more conceptual in feel than the Abex group, and as a result I think him and Rauschenberg now feel more contemporary, I suppose, than the Abex group, who I think I felt when I saw that show, I suddenly thought, wow, abstract expressionism has sort of got old, you know.
and is that, Jane, I wonder, is that the show is called Something Resembling Truth, is it that question of perception, that sort of playfulness, is that presumably what's being alluded to there?
Well, I think that's certainly the theory behind the show, and it's hard to avoid that. You know, if you've got, I'm not saying you should avoid it, but, you know, if you've got things that are, you know, American flags and now they're grey or metal or whatever, what does that mean? What does that symbol mean? So there's a lot of sort of questioning symbols. There's a lot of stuff about making it very clear, which, funnily enough, Basquiat does the same, making it very clear that the painting is an art object. It's not a window onto some other reality, you know. So you see exposed stretchers and you see things stuck on the canvas. You see the tools that you use in the studio. He made a lot of sculptures, you know, which were just sort of cans of, they're cast bronze, but they're just paint, you know, tins full of brushes, which he's turned into sculptures. There's rulers stuck on paintings. There's quite a lot of that's constantly alluding to the fact that this is an absolutely constructed object.
Indeed. Well, you can catch Something Resembling Truth by Jasper Johns at the Royal Academy until the 10th of December. Now, we're going to head out of the studio and nip down to South London again for an intergalactic wake. Last Friday marked the end of the Cassini space probe, an ambitious project by NASA that set out to study Saturn over the course of two decades. After 20 years of service, the probe plummeted into Saturn's atmosphere, and this sparked a group of artists to commemorate through poetic elegies and orchestral tearjerkers during a service held at Bold Tendencies in Peckham. Monocle's Jonathan Whitfield went along and met one of the artists, Emma Kate Matthews.
In 1997, the year of Men in Black.
And everybody interprets it in a totally different way. I think one of the really nice things about the way Ella has curated this project is that she's very carefully selected very artists with very different approaches and very different ideas about what a funeral means, what a tomb means, what the significance of the space mission is. And she hasn't imposed any sort of brief on us. She literally just said, I want you to create a piece of this medium, but you can do whatever you want with it. And I've built a tomb for the space probe, which crashed into the surface of Saturn only a few hours ago.
Could you give me a little bit of a background on the creative process that you went through?
So yeah, it evolved quite slowly. The brief that I was given was quite nice and open. I was essentially just asked to design and present a tomb for the Cassini space probe, and I thought, rather than making something that's got quite sort of negative connotations, I thought I'd try to do something that has a sort of positive spin on it. So I started thinking about the moment at which Cassini starts entering Saturn's atmosphere and starts to break apart, and the fact that this piece becomes fragmented. But it, when it was originally built, it would have been a sort of fragmented collection of parts that came together to make this amazing mission. And that's what really sparked this idea to have a piece that was essentially a collection of fragmented bits that then assemble visually in some way. So it's an anamorphic piece. If you view it from the side or from a distance, it looks like it's completely pulled apart, as if it had exploded. But if you see it from the very front, or if you see the silhouette of the shadow from the light source, it assembles into the sort of familiar silhouette of Cassini. So it's really describing Cassini at various points in its lifespan, but at the same time.
As a whole, the whole event, would you say it's raising questions about obsoleteness and about the idea of something that was once meant for something and then is discarded just in an instant?
I do think, with the having seen the press and the run-up to the Cassini, I guess, suicide mission when it crashed into the surface, I think people feel quite the opposite, actually, maybe thinking this isn't... Even though it is old technology, it's sort of 20-something years old, it's still relaying useful information, and was, you know, up until like 45 seconds before it died. I was watching the footage from NASA live TV this afternoon, and I could see there were these sort of screens with lots and lots of numbers and bits of data sort of coming back. And I think it's a shame that it had to finish now, but I think I was also reading the scientists who were dealing with the data from that descent today. It may take them several decades to decode everything. So even though it has gone, it's no longer relaying information back to the Earth. It feels like it's still very much a useful mission, and there's more in the future that it will give us.
You're with the Monocle Arts Review. Now, before we have this week's Global Countdown, we're rounding up our art-themed show with a trip to the cinema. Exhibition on Screen is a series of films that delve a little deeper into art shows around the world. They've covered everyone from David Hockney to Vincent van Gogh, and their latest documentary takes a look at Canaletto and the Art of Venice as Buckingham Palace plays host to a show of work by the Italian producer. Holly Fisher speaks with Exhibition on Screen's director, Phil Grebsky.
I think what we're good at is treading a number of very careful lines. The first one is that we know that 95% of our audience, because, you know, we're in Venezuela and Chile and New Zealand and so on and so forth, they can't possibly get to these shows. So we want to film the shows in such a way that it is the next best thing. Now, when we have the opportunity for the film to go out during the run of the exhibition, as it is with Canaletto, people will see the film first and then they'll go to the show because they're motivated to go to the show. We want people to go to galleries to experience art in the way that I love to experience it, in an art gallery. Now, it may be that you've missed the particular exhibition, but the film hopefully will also motivate you to go to your nearest gallery that has an artwork from that particular artist. So you know, we're trying to do both things. One of the reasons the galleries love to work with us is that they can spend 5-10 years on an exhibition, and then after 3 months it's gone forever. The film has preserved the exhibition, and galleries are always very pleased by that. The other fine line, which I think is something that we're very good at, is we make these films for a multiple of audiences, but broadly speaking, two audiences. You have the audience that knows something about the artist or the art or art history, but also there's an audience that may barely know the name. And people who know Canaletto are going to learn an awful lot, and people who've never really looked to him or know very much about him will also learn an awful lot and not feel lost at any point. The skill is remembering that it is a cinema film, and at the heart of any cinema film is storytelling. So we try to make sure that you're, as they say, entertained and informed at the same time.
Yeah, and these films are very accessible, as you say, for people from sort of all levels of art knowledge. Do you think that that is a problem within the art world generally, that, you know, people see it as a sort of elitist subject and they don't feel that it's accessible to them?
I think there is a bit of that, actually. I mean, I think the art world is a little bit responsible for turning some people off, because actually it's a bit like program notes at classical music concerts, or, you know, sometimes I read them and I haven't a clue what they're talking about because you've pitched them too high. And I think that the art world sometimes makes, you know, almost obscures an understanding of what the art is. And it's not enough to say, I did it, therefore it's art. People are intelligent and they want some clues. They want the doors to be opened to help them understand. And I think that's what's something that we can do. And sometimes I think the art world doesn't do. And I think, you know, it's a broad argument to say this, but sometimes the art world talks to itself and not to the broader audience. Having said that, if you go to a gallery in London, for example, or Manchester or Liverpool or wherever, practically any day of the week, but particularly at weekends, they are packed. And it's across the board. It's young people, old people, and so on and so forth. It's a well-known statistic, and it's been checked more than once. More people go to art galleries in a week than go to football matches. You'd never know it when you read the newspapers or watch TV, and I'm a football fan, but there is a huge appetite, and I think that appetite can be furthered.
And you've done films about everyone from Canaletto to David Hockney. I mean, they're obviously very different artists, and, you know, David Hockney is still alive. So how do you go into each film? How do you approach each one you make?
It's a good question. And, you know, again, one of our ambitions was to be as broad in time as we could be. So last year we did Bosch, so that's 500 plus years ago. And at the same time, we were making Hockney, who, as you say, is still alive. Personally, I like to start from a position of not making things too complicated. So with Cézanne, and it's for, you know, it coincides with the curatorial approach to the exhibition, but it's chronological. Chronology is an easy narrative to follow, and unless there's any particular reason, I'm quite happy to follow a narrative which essentially starts with the early years of an artist working through to their latter years. Hockney was different. We didn't want to do a retrospective. There was a film made 4 or 5 years ago, which is a decent kind of full retrospective of his life. What we wanted to focus on were the two Royal Academy exhibitions, which themselves were focusing on his later works. So for us, it was about showing those two exhibitions, which were seen by 750,000 people in London, which is massive of any scale, but massive for the Royal Academy. And now they're gone, but we've got them on film, obviously. And then wrap around that three interviews. Canaletto was different. Canaletto was more about following the line of the exhibition, investigating who Canaletto was, really looking hard at his paintings, which are, I mean, I've learned so much and appreciate them far more than I did. But also there are other stories there and involved a lot of filming in Venice. And then Cézanne, as I say, is much more of a kind of biography wrapped around the portraits exhibition, which is Paris, London and Washington. Which is itself is essentially a chronological exhibition, but we also broaden out the story and go to southern France and so forth. So each film determines a little bit how we tell the story.
That was Phil Grabsky, director of Exhibition on Screen. To find out more info about screenings and films on offer, head to exhibitiononscreen.com. Now, to end the show, it's of course time for this week's Global Countdown. Fernando is back in the studio. Hello, Faye. Where are we going today?
Well, I even make a comparison with the art world. I think the art world, there's always a country that is, you know, is the coolest country at the moment to look at what are the main artists. In the music world, I think the country to look for is Norway, actually, at the moment. So if you're in the know, go and check the Norwegian charts. Because, you know, Sweden, we know already that they're excellent. They're one of the biggest music markets in the world. But Norway is catching up. I'm going to, you know, read up the top five here. Even though it's quite international, but wait until the number one.
Okay.
Shall we do a little countdown?
Wait with bated breath. Let's start at number five.
Number five, we have the British singer Dua Lipa with New Rules. I mean, that video is excellent. You know, it's quite summery and, you know, she's doing very well here in the UK and just starting to climb in the US charts. She has a wonderful voice, I have to say, very soulful. She's only 22 as well. Number four, again, Despacito. I'm still talking about Despacito here after months and months, but it's still there, you know, we can't deny. Number three, have a double Sweden, Avicii. Do you know much about Avicii, the Swedish DJ?
Blank faces greet Fernando from around the table. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you a bit, you know, he's the one, he does country house, that's his rhythm. And country house does very well in big stadiums, big arenas. It's mildly tacky, but it's okay, it works, you know. He's there, number three, with a fellow Swedish singer, Sandro Cavazza.
I have to say, a country house weekend definitely means something very different to me. I don't know about my co-panelists, but there we go. It takes all sorts, doesn't it?
Exactly. Number two, another duo, we have Justin Bieber, again, always on the charts, with Blood Pop, which is an American producer. He does songs for Lady Gaga and much more. The song's called Friends, you know, a very nice electropop track. But shall we hear the number one? I want to hear your opinion.
We have to listen. There's a positive sense of anticipation here,
yes,
in the studio, Fernando. What is at the top of the tree?
Well, let's hear it, and then I'll tell you later. Maybe I should think before I talk. I get emotional and words come out all wrong. Sometimes I'm more honest than I want. So maybe I should think before. Maybe next time I'll think before. I know that I should think before I speak. 'Cause I'm saying things that I don't even mean. Who was that, Fernando? That was Astrid S. with the song's called Think Before I Talk, which has been a major hit in Norway for a few weeks now. And I have to say, yeah, she's Norwegian indeed. I like to see local artists topping the charts. She was actually fifth on the Norwegian Idol. Yeah, but that's the thing about those shows. The winner is never like that good in the end. So usually the fourth or the fifth place, they're the more interesting ones. And I think she has a lovely voice. You know, she's doing very well now in the neighboring countries like Denmark and Sweden. I think she's collaborating with Katy Perry here and there. So I see actually a bright future for her. And any opinion, guys?
What do we think of that?
It didn't sound very Norwegian. It sounded kind of Euro pop, you know, sort of fairly run of the mill. I don't know if it was.
It's not an overly enthusiastic endorsement.
I mean, well, I expect a little bit more kind of originality. I don't know. Maybe not.
That's fair.
For number one. Maybe
no. That's true. She's Astrid unfined. S. What does S stand for? Have you completed your research?
Well, I didn't complete my research.
Oh,
but,
dear.
But I can tell you, it's not. I think there's a singer with the same name in the 90s. But please don't mix it up. And you know, I did mention that Norway is like the place where cool artists are growing up. So we have another Norwegian singer that is doing very well outside Norway. Actually, Sigrid. We even play her at Monaco 24. We had, you know, Annie in the past. There's so much more, actually. But Astrid S, and she's only 20, so, you know.
20?
She's only 20.
Sobering thought. Jane, what about you? Would you be playing that at home, maybe?
Kind of a bit bubblegum pop.
It's very bubblegum pop, yeah, in some
ways. Didn't really like it even in the 80s.
Okay, well, maybe Astrid can just keep her sights focused on Norway for the time being. She's only 20. She's got plenty. She's got time on her side. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks to my guests, Ossian Ward and Jane Morris. This programme was produced by Holly Fisher. Research by Fernando. Fernando, thanks for that. And, of course, for your Global Countdown too. I'm Tom Edwards. To play us out, despite what may be misgivings from the panellists, let's have a little more of that number one track. This is Astrid S with Think Before I Talk. I said I hate you, I was angry. I got so mad I slammed your door. You know I really love you, baby.
I know there's a line, but I crossed it, and I pray that it won't leave a scar.